Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is brought to you with the welcome support of Maltbean Creek, UK's leading Greek delicatessen, supplier and distributor of premium Greek produce. Be it wine, herbs, cheeses or olive oil, from all over the wild corners of Greece, and working directly with small artisan producers. If you want to try some amazing traditional meats from Greece, preserved meats, why don't you get some Vavourakis organic smoked tsiglino from Maltbean Creek? So this is preserved and smoked pork in olive oil, and they follow a traditional Cretan recipe for it, which is really old. And the meat is smoked using olive wood, and it's flavored with pepper and cumin. Or you can try the organic Cretan sausages with cumin and vinegar. Again, another old Cretan recipe with roots to the Byzantine Empire. Whatever you need, Maltbean Creek has you covered. You can shop online and have the exquisite goods delivered to your doorstep across the UK, or you can visit the shop at Arch 17 Apollo Business Park, Lucy Way, SE16 4ET, Bermondsey, London. Maltbean Creek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. And, of course, for all you dear listeners, Maltbean Creek has an amazing discount of 15% off your next purchase. So go online, go to the website and type maltbeangreek.com/delicious and you get 15% discount at the checkout. My name is Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. On each episode, I find some ancient recipe, ingredient, or tantalizing element from ancient cuisines, which has a fascinating story to tell to our modern selves. Today's episode is diverging a little bit, but I always want to know more about the Cornwall Project and Carl Yeo Mutton, a meat not so popular in UK, but here's our man that is fighting to change this, Matt Chatfield. We talk about traditional farming, timeless ancient techniques, silvopasture, and how this will help humankind for the future too. Matt's an incredible character. He's a farmer and a person full of passion and energy for quality produce, alongside making the planet a better place for future generations. We've talked about many subjects here for a length of time, so here's an edited version of our chat with some of our most interesting bits of it. Our online interview was very challenging, as Matt is obviously down in Cornwall in his caravan, somewhere in a field with only a mobile phone and sporadic 4G signal. We were regularly losing connection due to wind apparently, and the quality of the audio is not the best one, I'm afraid. But nevertheless, I think you will enjoy the knowledge that Matt kindly offered here and shared with all of us. Matt highlights the fact that there are many farmers that they are doing an excellent work, both to feed the people and also care for nature. And from what it looks like from my side, to be honest, basically there are lots and lots of people out there doing their best for nature and for the environment. But the main obstacle, as always, is governments not listening to us, but to mega money from multinational corporations. As a result, nothing seems to change for the better long term. Instead, we create new problems on top of the already existing ones. Anyway, I hope you enjoy Matt's thoughts and actions and buy his lovely aged mutton. Incredibly tasty and versatile. Thank you.
Welcome to our podcast, The Delicious Legacy, Matt. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, no worries. Nice to be here.
And I've been obviously following you for a couple of years on online, on Twitter mainly, and Instagram and so on. But yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what do you do, and all that stuff, how you started, for our listeners, basically, about the Kallio project and the Kallio Meat and the Kallio project and all that.
So I come from a farming background. I'm actually now sitting on our farm. It's been in the farm, my family, for about 400 years. We've been farming it. I've only actually, well, we farmed it on behalf of a big estate for about 360 years. And then my granddad was able to buy it 40 years ago. But it's only a small farm. It was about 80 acres. When my granddad passed away, it was basically 40 acres each. Because my the two sisters, one of them being my mum, got half each. So basically, he was like a dairy farmer. Never really had a chance to take on the farm because it was felt to be just too small. You know, he was a dairy farmer, and at that time, you know, as he was sort of retiring, dairy farming was very difficult. So we never encouraged a farm. But I always wanted to. I went off to London, did publishing for like 10 or 12 years. About 14 years ago, my nan passed away, but she passed away. I spent a lot of time with her and decided that I wanted to somehow try and get the farm working again. But I need to do that. You know, I basically knew that it was very hard to make profit from a small farm. So I took the decision to approach my local butcher, Philip Warren Butcher, the son called Ian Warren, with the idea of supplying restaurants in London with their meat.
Yeah.
They're very recognized, you know, very, very respected local butcher. We you know, we didn't know how good their meat was compared to the rest of the country, but down here, you know, they...
That's great. So basically,
decided to take on the farm, but I knew I couldn't actually, I couldn't actually farm. And this is before the days of sort of like farmers markets and local cheeses and things. So I knew that to be able to farm, I needed to actually have a guaranteed market for high-end product. So I approached my butcher, Philip Warren, or his son, Ian, and I basically went to London and set up a restaurant business for them. So we set up a supply chain over to 10 years, supplying the best restaurants in London with their meat. And the idea was I was always going to come back and farm. And so I was actually going to supply them a beef. We have a breed of cattle down here called the Red Ruby. His real name is North Devon. But basically, you know, through lots of different things that happened in London. And, you know, I ended up spent 2 years on a houseboat learning about farming, about after being in London for 10 years. And I went over to Extremadura and spent quite a lot of time with the Hamon people out there, the Iberico pig farmers.
Yeah.
I realised that, you know, I personally view Hamon as the best meat in the world. So I was very interested to see how that happens. And what I realised was that you have an animal that walks a lot in its life, which basically puts muscle, you know, the more an animal walks in its life, the more flavour goes into the muscle. And then they put on this huge amount of fat at the end of their life on acorns.
Yeah.
So I suddenly realized that was actually quite similar to our sheep, basically. So sheep, you know, probably lived 7 or 8 years, have walked a very long time, you know, walked miles and miles in that time. They've generally had grass all their lives. So I thought, why not take the sheep that aren't any good for breeding anymore and basically fatten them on pasture? So basically, what my whole thing is, you know, I try and do as much good to the environment as I can whilst fattening sheep and giving them a really good retirement, basically.
Yeah.
So it's different things. So, you know, there's a lot that happened to make me get there. But essentially now on the farm, I'm now selling my mutton. But I actually call it co-yaw. So basically when a farmer feels like his sheep aren't any good for breeding, he culls them.
Yeah.
Which is why they're called cattle. And the local colloquial name for you is yaw. So that's why I call it co-yaw. And my whole thing is I want to speak farmers' language. I don't really want to, you know, I want farmers to understand that I'm on their side and I speak their language. It's a bit of a gamble calling it co-yaw. But yeah, it seems to work really. So after all that time, I now through the supply chain we set up, now sell that meat two restaurants in London, basically.
Great, great. Yes, I think one of my friends, chef friends, Vasilis Hamam, I think he used quite a lot of your mutton, I think, because either from the Cornwall project. So I think I found you through him.
Well, Vasilis actually worked for me at a place called Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
And that's when I first discovered this sheep, because it was actually a different... our delivery driver, his father-in-law was a farmer, was looking to retire from beef farming, and he's actually came up with... It was actually his idea to come up with fattening sheep. So when I was at the Adam and Eve pub, Vasilis was there with my head chef at the time, Michael Harrison.
Yeah.
And basically we actually did mutton there. So that was, you know... So 6 years later, well, 4 or 5 years later, I ended up, you know, that was the basis of the idea. And that's, you know, so when I went to Extra Madura, I realised why that mutton we used to use at the Adam and Eve was so good. Yeah, so look, Vasilis is great. So he's just recently left London, but he was brilliant. He's a really, yeah, really, really good. He ended up doing really, really well over here. And I hope he's doing pretty well back home, really.
Yeah, I hope so too. Yeah, I think he will do well. But yeah, I think through him, I found out more about you, and I was very interested always to try your meat. So I did try it from Vasilis, but now I got some. Okay. I ordered some from Philip Warren for. So I've got some of that to cook for myself here in my barbecue. So you're doing something called Silver Pasture, if I'm not mistaken.
So what I'm trying to do is, I mean, I think if I start, I think farmers are being asked to do 4 things in the future. And I think farmers are being asked to, A, feed people, hopefully highly nutritious, high quality food. They're going to be asked to basically sequester carbon, so take carbon from the atmosphere and put it into the soil and store it. They're going to be asked to increase biodiversity. And they're going to be asked, and I think this is the most important one actually, is to be able to store water into the soil. So, you know, the climate is changing. We're getting very wet winters, dry summers. Water is incredibly precious. So rather than put it on land where it just washes away and goes, you know, straight out to sea, we need to store it on land. So really, it's coming up with farming methods that hit all those sweet spots, really. But also, the most important is, you know, as I'm now farming sheep, sheep are ruminant. They have 4 stomachs. They are a walking miracle. You know, we need to respect them and give them an incredible life while they're on this planet. So my farming method and silver pasture basically is the sweet spot between all of those. If you look at Project Drawdown, so there's an organization called Project Drawdown, I think 100 scientists around the world worked out the best ways of drawing carbon from the atmosphere and storing it down here. Silver pasture is number 9. And silver pasture is simply... I haven't invented everything. I might pretend I do, but hopefully it's just basically what we always used to do. And around the world, they still do it, is farming in trees, basically. So it's basically grazing in woodland.
Yeah.
I saw a talk by a chap called Steve Gabriel, and anybody listening to this really ought to try and listen to it. There was a Oxford Real Farming Conference, you know, about 3 years ago, and a chap called Steve Gabriel from upstate New York talked on it. If you're on YouTube, you can find it. He spoke for an hour, and it was basically, he was a conservationist and a farmer. He had some sheep. There was a really bad drought. Everybody's sheep and cattle in the area were really struggling. He put his sheep into a woodland. He didn't know what else to do. And a month later, they came out really fit and healthy. So he just suddenly really got into it. So he's discovered by accident. And then basically, you know, when I saw that talk, it was about a year before I started farming. But it's something that I always, you know, just stuck in my mind. Basically, you know, it gives you drought resistance, but also, you know, if you've got trees and you've got grass and you've got ruminants, like, you know, you're pumping so much carbon into the soil and keeping it there. It's just phenomenal, really. But when I came back to the family farm, we've only got 40 acres and 10 acres of that are ancient woodland. Our family haven't farmed in there literally for 300 years. So between 300 and 400 years ago, it's very obvious that they did farm it, but then it's just been left. So I've gone in there with a chainsaw, clearing areas, letting light in, putting a sheep in, and it's just absolutely exploded into life. So now I've actually seen it. It's actually just a miracle. You know, it's the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. You know, like, and it's just, you just need a chainsaw and some sheep, and then it's absolutely just you know, I've got, you know, it was basically dead, the floor of the woodland, because it was there was like a complete tree cover, like no light was going in.
Yeah.
And there's probably like all we had was wooden sod and ivy on the floor. I've just cleared a bit of space. And when you coppice, it still means it grows back. So it's not like you're killing a tree.
Mm.
And it grows back. But I've probably got about 200 different plants growing from the floor, all from the seed bank. And some of those seeds might have been there 400 years. It's just insane. And, you know, and I met another chap called Chris Jones. He actually talked at the same conference about silvopasture. I met him just before I started farming. And I was very scared because I just didn't actually know how to farm.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you look after nature, then flavor looks after yourself. And it's the most inspirational words I've ever heard. And basically, I was a countryside ranger for a while. I did environmental studies background. I'm obsessed with nature. So nature is something that I can look after. So essentially, I just look after nature by using the sheep, and incredible things happen, really.
Yeah, that's an incredible thing. And that's what something that people don't know, obviously. So we townies, we don't know about farming, obviously. And we don't know about, we might love nature, and we actually, we're passionate about conservation and about wildlife and about, you know, the term rewilding. We love that idea, but we actually don't know the reality on the ground.
I mean, the reality is, you know, when I did my 2 years of study on the houseboat, it was all just theory, but now I've actually seen it. Basically, the whole world is just, you know, I've now seen it, you know, so I'm not speaking, you know, like, it's hard to sound like a religious zealot, really, but ruminants are, I basically say that, like the sun is the fuel and ruminants the engine. And when you actually see what ruminants do and how intrinsic they are to the carbon cycle, they are the carbon cycle, basically. The sun goes down, the sun comes down, hits the plants are photosynthesized, that goes into the soil, that sort of feeds the plants. The ruminants then come along and they basically eat, you know, all these different products. It goes into them, their first stomach, comes up again, they chew their cud, goes back down again, it goes into the rumen where basically it ferments. So it's basically a fermentation chamber. So it's taking all these nutrients out of stuff that we, no way that we can.
Yeah.
But the most incredible thing is, and this is where it just gets, it's just crazy, is as long as you don't worm sheep, then basically the poo goes through the sheep. And because it hasn't been wormed, you get something called dung beetles. And we have 60 species of dung beetle in this country. They basically suck all the liquid out from the poo. I know it sounds terrible, but then what it leaves behind is this absolute miracle substance. And then when it rains, this poo, like, it just goes into the soil, and you just see the magic that happens around it. Like, it's just that it feeds, I personally believe it feeds the fungal network. It just, like, gets everything moving. So my personal belief is you can overgraze, of course you can, but without ruminants, like, you know, the whole soil, everything is driven by ruminant, you know, ruminant poo that hasn't been wormed, basically. And when, you know, now I've seen it in my woodland, you know, I mean, I've had people there, like, you came out 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Now they've come now. And honestly, like, you know, you know, we had some chefs. I mean, actually, strange enough, a chap called Midu. So he's a Greek chef from, he's the head chef at Kiln. So he, you know, good friend of mine, brilliant chef, came down like 2 years ago. They basically thought I was doing like eco-terrorism in my wood. And I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah, because it was messy. There was mud, you know, and there were trees coming down. And now they've gone in there and it's basically just like paradise. It's just, you know, it's utter paradise. You know, like the transformation in 2 years.
It's just unbelievable. Incredible. Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole ecosystem needs not just, you can't have just trees and expect the woodland to thrive. You need to have animals.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a guy in, I've only really found one person who's as crazy as I am in terms of his thinking, really. And he's only got about 10 sheep, but he's farmed in Poland. But his thinking is just so out there. And what he sort of says is, like, there used to be dinosaurs, and there used to be woody mammoths, and there used to be just these huge, huge animals going through woodland, crashing them down. And he said, like, the amount of imagination you need to even think about what it used to be like, you know, like, we're so naive in just thinking the world is what it is now, and it always has been, you know, like, the whole country was covered in woodland, and you know there was no gaps. Like there would have been huge gaps, huge swathes,
and
for me, like to know that there would have been huge gaps. Like I would say, one of my favourite summer visitor is the swallow. The swallow comes all the way from Africa to here, and basically, swallows don't feed over trees; they feed over pasture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obvious that swallows haven't just been coming here since we farmed. They've been coming here since they've existed.
Yeah.
So it's obvious that if you just need to look at the animals that come to the UK during the summer to realise that we've always had open plains and we've had woodland, and you know, like it's just obvious. Really.
It's just a mixture of environments, of course. And I mean, we are in the situation that we have obviously we need to feed the population as well. And how do we do that without damaging damaging anymore, but also nurture and heal nature. And I think that's what people must understand, I suppose, from farmers like you.
I think we can do it really, really easily, actually. I think if you do follow Twitter, I call Instagram my sales and marketing division, and Twitter's my political wing. I get quite grumpy with that. But basically, I think we're being pushed down a direction where the corporate world wants to take over the food supply of, you know, the world, as it were. You know, they want to do a complete corporate food supply chain.
Yeah.
So really, like, we now have the science to realise that what our ancestors are doing. And my granddad used chemicals. He was part of that generation where you just pump the soil full of chemicals. You plough it, plant monoculture ryegrass, and you use chemicals. But his generation before him used mixed farming. So they would graze cattle in an area for like 2 or 3 years. They would then plant veg. They would use the ruminants to get the soil working, and then plant veg, extract carbon, but then do that for 2 years, and then, you know, and now we've got the technology and science to actually realise that we can do that, but on a more, you know, a lot more efficient system.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm a little farm, and I view my job is to make mutton really, really popular. And it's very funny in Greece. There's actually Alex at where Valet Vassalis did work.
Yeah, in Catalyst. Alex.
Alex's boss told me that in Greece there is a online mutton club with 250,000 members. 250,000 members of a mutton club in Greece. That is insane, isn't it?
That's insane.
I view my job as to make mutton really popular. I personally think the biggest challenge farming has in the UK is the age of farmers. I'm 49.
Yeah.
I go to the market and everyone calls me young man. So basically farmers are getting very old. We need to get a lot of new people into farming. I think what I'm doing is just the most simple way of farming, which is basically get some old sheep and basically put them on grass or in woodland and fatten them. And anyone can do it. You know, you have to work hard and listen and learn. But anyone can do what I do. You just basically need some electric fence and some water trough, and that's it, and some land. So what I think, my job is to make mutton really, really popular and get everybody talking about it, which is sort of happening. But then where the revolution happens is on the arable land. So I've got a friend called Max. He's a return to a sheep farmer in Hertfordshire. So he works with on a place called Duchess Farm. They're an arable system. He came down and saw me, looked at how to do it for 5 days. He's now gone up there and he's now farming sheep on an arable system where he's now using strip grazing to improve the arable land, and then they're basically planting wheat. So he's done it in the space of a year. He's got it up and running. So I would say the revolution is going to happen whereby at the moment the arable farmers are using chemicals as their input. They're having to use pesticides and they're having to use fertilizer. The sheep are replacing both those things. His sheep are... Well, they're not a pesticide, but they're getting rid of the plants that he doesn't need, which is black grass.
Yeah.
And they're adding all the poo as the fertilizer.
Yeah.
And so basically, I think arable systems, rather than being a separate system, livestock and arable, they need to come back together like they used to.
Mm.
But because now we've got electric fencing and stuff, you can just be so efficient with your grazing. So if you just keep moving your sheep, like every day, new patch of land with your electric fence, basically they start trampling in organic matter. They feed the worms, they poo, they feed the dung beetles, and it just, everything just kicks into place. Yeah. So, and I think I did some sums. I've got a friend of mine. So with me, you never have to ask many questions. I tend to go off on
good,
one. A friend of mine called Frederick at Stanley Farm, he's using Tamworth pigs on his arable farm. And I did some sums for Friends of the Earth. I did a bit of work for Friends of the Earth in Northern Ireland a few years ago. And basically, Fred uses Tamworth pigs, moves them around for like 3 years on the arable land by planting a herbal lay. So he plants about 30 different plants. The pigs eat them for 3 years, and then he plants heritage wheat. I did sums where it showed, well, at the moment, we've got 9 million pigs in factories in the UK. Horrendous. I hate factory farming. If 20% of farmers use pigs like Fred does, that would be 99 million pigs on fields instead of in factories. And my feeling is, you know, you basically, all your land then is being used to produce wheat and meat. And my thinking is, you know, in time, Fred will have sums. And I think the sums will show he's saving a huge amount of money because he's not spending on chemicals. And his input is actually, he's making money from his input to his system. It are pigs, which are actually an output, if you see what I mean. So I think doing that, you could get incredibly healthy animals, very good, highly nutritious meat, but you would get a lot of it as well. You know, like if you just think, yeah, you know, so I actually think it's just the easiest thing in the world actually to solve our food problem. But I would say we're being told that ruminants are killing the planet. And I've no doubt at all that it is a conspiracy. And I use the word conspiracy because I think like most conspiracies seem to be coming true at the moment. I don't think if a conspiracy is actually true, I just don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I would say Big Ag wants to take control of the food system, and they can't really control ruminants, but what they can control is, you know, the growing of plants and, you know, these sorts of things. So I think it's, you know, it's a play by them. So, you know, it's obvious, you know, all the government stuff that's come out this week and all these conference things, they're just not mentioning farming, they're not mentioning carbon sequestration. You know, it's just, you know, there's something very weird going on at the moment, I think. And I think it's because, you know, the corporate world wants to take over the food supply, really. But I make no secret of that on my Instagram. It's not like I'm saying something new. You know, I've been going on about it for 5 years, basically.
It's very difficult at the moment, isn't it? Because from one hand, you have the movement saying we need to eat a lot more, obviously, vegetarian diet. But at the same time, they invest on all these fake meat products, and it's okay. What are we actually doing here?
It's I mean, I don't do this. But I'm not. Well, like, to be honest, I am anti-vegan now, and I'll tell you why I'm anti-vegan is because if you stood on my land within 30 seconds, you will realise that the vegan movement is nonsense. And, you know, it may sound a big thing to say, but I'm now sitting on my land. I'm surrounded by my fields. The way I graze, basically, I'm creating an environment. I kill 20 ruminant beings per acre per year. So on average, for every acre of land I've got, I kill 20 sheep. They feed people, you know, probably provide thousands of meals. But I'm providing a habitat for literally tens of thousands of sentient beings. Like today, I saw a peregrine falcon take a pigeon over my land. I walked over my fields and I saw frogs, I saw mice, I saw vultures. Tonight, I've seen a barn owl flying over my land. If you planted, say, wheat or oats, or you wouldn't get any of that. You would kill tens of thousands of human beings. So, and not only did you kill them at that time, you kill them forevermore.
Yeah.
So my land is providing the most, you know, like I say, so, and the reason I'm now just becoming anti-vegan is I had a lady come down, I won't mention her name, but basically she bought some koryul online, and then she sent me an email, you know, sort of saying she liked it.
Yeah.
She asked me loads of questions, which I couldn't really answer. So I invited her down. Well, she actually stayed down here at a friend, or like a Coombshead restaurant. She came over to see my farm, and then, it basically, and I'm not doing this to be, you know, it's hard to do this without me sound like a hero, but essentially she had very bad food eating issues. And essentially she was vegan, and it was all driven by guilt. And in her own words, she basically would have died. She was on the way to dying. And she saw koryul, she saw the way I was doing it. She thought it sounded very ethical. So she took a gamble, ate some. And it basically started on the road to recovery. She now goes to Coombshead, stays there. eats their food. And she was driven by guilt and driven by all these messages to basically not eat meat. And it basically was going to kill her.
Mm.
She's actually now visited. And obviously, I didn't realise how important it was when she visited. Like, you imagine if I actually had my sheep in cages and it was all nonsense. But it wasn't, you know, she just came down. She saw what it was, loved it, you know, very happy with it. So I'm like, I don't think she's alone. I think there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of particularly women, actually, young women, who for one reason or another have been driven to associate eating with guilt and body yeah. issues. And I think the vegan movement is using those people. And I think, you know, from my own research and from people I know, the second smartest person I ever met, a lady called Valerie, she basically is a brain, she studied brain function and nutrition for like a long time. She's now treating people. And she says that all the people she treats are teenage girls who are vegan and they've all got glutamate deficiency. They're not able to get glutamate from their diet. And she said most of the people she's treating are going to have they will never be physically or mentally the same ever again. She said they've done too much damage. So I'm now at the point where I've seen my system. The whole plant-based thing is nonsense because it doesn't work for planet or human health, you know? Like, so yeah, sorry to go on about it, but yeah, it's one of those things where I'm like, since this lady came down and I've realised how guilty she was made to feel, I'm just like, it's time just to shout and say, look, this needs to stop because, you know, I've now seen what ruminants do and without ruminants.
Yeah.
I honestly think the only chance we've got on this planet is getting ruminants as a key part of the system again and get the planet and the soil working again.
Yeah.
And we can suppress a huge amounts of carbon. You know, if you think carbon is the issue, the only way naturally we can get carbon from up there, down there, is by using ruminants, basically. Anyway. I went on one then.
yeah. Oh, that's excellent. There's a lot of things there to ponder and discuss, of course. I mean, one of the things that the problem is, I was reading recently, there's too few farmers in UK. I think there's like 1% of the population.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Or less. Or is it about 1%?
I think, yeah, I mean, yeah, maybe. I mean, down here, there's a lot of us, you know, where I am in Devon, stroke Cornwall. But yeah, I think nationally, there's a lot of people employed indirectly from farming, you know. So it's a bigger industry than, I mean, down here in Cornwall and Devon, it is the biggest industry, even though we've got tourism. So, you know. But yeah. So your point was, I've got to do it, so carry on.
Yeah, well, so yeah, I was listening about another podcast about agriculture and somebody called Colin Tudge and was talking about that we need at least like maybe 20% of the population to be farmers. And I think so we can have a more balanced system and have something, you know, to feed the country basically. And currently what we do, while there's a few people like you, but mostly we have industrial farms, and which is it's basically the opposite of what we should be doing, basically. We don't help the environment and we don't help feed the people healthy stuff. How can we change that? Obviously you help it with your way, but how can you make it?
So basically, when I went to the Oxford Real Farming Conference, I'd heard about Regen Ag about 4 years ago, and Regen Ag is essentially using ruminants to improve your soil, you know, by basically keep on moving your sheep or your, you know, ruminants. It's basically, you know, you're using it's a farming method to improve your soil. Now, I heard about it 4 years ago. I was shouting about it for 2 years. I was on Twitter, I was on Instagram. I was shouting at all the journalists to say, you need to be talking about this. And I actually thought I was probably one of the only people who knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
I then went to the Oxford Real Farming Conference. And there were 1,000 people there, and every single one of them was smarter than me, was doing more than me, knew more than me. And it was obvious that there is a huge movement out there. It's basically almost like a silent revolution. So it is actually happening, but it's just, well, then it wasn't being talked about, but now it's beginning to be talked about. So basically, there's this huge movement. You know, I went to another conference this year, Groundswell, and there were thousands of people thousands of people wanted to go but couldn't get tickets. And so there is actually a huge movement happening. My personal belief is journalists are just crap, right? Or editors are crap. I think they just pander to their advertisers.
Yeah.
I also think social media platforms are, a lot of the big social media companies are invested in plant-based stuff. And I would say algorithms are designed to highly promote plant-based material rather than this farming material.
Yeah.
But basically, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people doing what I'm doing, and a lot of people are doing it a hell of a lot better than me. So I think there is actually a huge movement out there, and it's happening. And I would say, I've come back to Cornwall, and I play cricket. And I play cricket, the team I used to play for 25 years ago. They're all sheep farmers. I've come back. They all think I'm, well, they don't think I'm crazy. They probably just think I'm a bit of a twat, really. But we get on very well. They're all beginning to think the way I am. You know, they're all quite conventional. The price of fertilizer is literally trebled this year. They won't be able to put as much fertilizer down here. They're going to have to start using new methods to farm. So what I'm saying is, I think just by the price, the way the world is going, farmers are going to have to farm like this. There's plenty of us doing it. There's plenty of us that they can now come to advice for. I go to them for advice on actually how do you make money farming. And I think they're going to start coming to me, asking me for advice on how do they make the soil fertile without using chemicals. So, I take your point. But I think, again, going back to my previous point, I think my job is to show, get Martin famous, but also show people that anyone can do this style of farming. And I just want as many new entrants coming in as possible. And I've probably got about 10 people who are now farming on the back of what I'm doing. And I've got like 10 other people supplying me. And you know, so I think, yeah. So to answer your question, I think it's happening, actually.
It's happening.
I think it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you know, obviously a lot of the things that you hear.
But it could be instant.
It's not going to be instant. It's not going to be from one day to the next. But a lot of the things that we hear is about how expensive land is and obviously how difficult it is for young people to go to land and farm, even if you want to. So it's always, you know, an obstacle. I mean, so yeah, there's not going to be young people farming, and as you said, you're the youngest.
I think, I mean, there are lots of younger people that are doing it. Like I say, my hope would be that arable farmers don't really want to farm livestock. My hope is there's a huge opportunity for young people. And I say, I don't care if you're young. I don't care if you're gay. I don't care, you know, what colour you are, what sexuality. If you want to farm, you should be able to farm. You know, whatever age, whoever you are.
Yeah.
If you want to farm, you should be able to farm. And I think by looking at what Max is doing at Dutch's Farm, I think the big opportunity for new entrants is to approach arable farmers and say, can I graze animals on your land? Mm-hmm. You know, can you plant a herbal lay? Can I be responsible for your animals? And then it's just an incredibly easy and good way to get into farming. And I think the arable farmer wins, the new entrant wins. So I actually think what Max is doing at Dutch's is really important because he's literally never seen a sheep in his life until last year. He's now got like 100 sheep, you know, and then next year he's looking at 200, then 300. Max is showing what is actually just really possible. And it's not easy. But then, you know, if you want to farm, you know, if you really want to farm, you should be able to. And Max is proving it. And, you know, I'm hoping then other arable farmers open the doors and say, look, you know, if you want to learn to farm, if you want to do livestock, come to my farm, do it. You
fantastic.
Know, that to me is just such an obvious opportunity for new entrants. And he's based in Hertfordshire. So if you've got a lot of listeners in London, who've never even thought about farming, just get on your train. It's 20 minutes from Liverpool Street Station to Sawbridgeworth. You can just go up and see Max, you know, invite yourself up, go and have a look around. So anyway, you know, and that's why I love the fact that it's so close to London because, you know, it's accessible for everyone, really.
Yeah. And obviously the other important point is mutton is delicious and more people should be eating mutton. And that's another thing I don't understand why mutton is not extremely popular.
It's all the supermarkets, isn't it? So the supermarkets, they want something that's exactly the same size. So with lamb does that for them. You know, it looks the same size, it's consistent. So, you know, this easy food, this easy distribution, mutton just isn't that. Every single sheep I've got is different, basically. So it just doesn't fit that. So, but, you know, with the advent of farmers markets and online shopping and people coming, you know, it's hopefully, you know, this is the time for it to shine. But it's just, I guess what people haven't done before is put fat on them. So what generally happens with a sheep, so the sheep's lambed about 5 times. It's probably had about 10 lambs. The farmer then feels it's no longer fit for breeding. But what generally happens is that sheep will then, you know, so it's just had its last lot of lambs. It's just weaned them naturally, but it's very thin because it's been eating to produce milk for its lambs. Imagine the bigger the lambs get, the more milk they have. So the poor sheep has been putting all that energy into lambs. Generally then, say a farmer's got 100, well, say he's got 1,000 sheep, he probably replaces 15% of his flock each year. So he's got 150 sheep that he wants to get rid of. They either go straight to the abattoir, so they're all thin, they go straight to the abattoir, or they go to a market where abattoirs buy them. Mm-hmm. So they're auctioned off, they're then taken to the abattoir and killed. So you've got this animal that's basically hasn't got any fat on it, and it's not its best. And then basically they generally not age it, it's eaten straight away. And it is tough. If you don't age this meat, it's tough. And it's got no fat cover, so there's no flavour. So what I'm doing is just getting them fat, basically. And some sheep, some sheep will get fat in 6 weeks. Some take 6 months, and some take actually 2 years. So I bought some 2 years ago, and they've just been there hanging around, and they finally got fat this year. So I felt a bit bad, but I also thought, like, 2 years just sitting around eating grass, you know, it's not, I'm just living in trees, it's not bad.
They're loving the life.
So basically, we dry age it. So with Philip Warren Butcher, incredible butcher, they've got a really good dry aging facility. And basically, what you do with the aging process is mutton is tough because it's walked a lot in its life. That's where the flavour comes from. So you need to age it. And what the aging process is there's an enzyme called calpain. All meat in this country has an enzyme called calpain. So when an animal dies, that meat is actually what starts making the meat deteriorate. So what you're doing is you're trying to encourage calpain to grow. And calpain, it needs moisture and not too cold. That basically starts working, starts breaking down the meat, starts making it tender. Mm-hmm. So we do that for like 3 weeks. And then for 2 weeks, we then put it into a dry aging fridge. And the dry aging fridge, slowly taking the moisture out of that meat, which increases the flavour. Mm-hmm. So it's basically like a 3 or 4 week process. And you end up with, you know, a very tender meat that's just full of flavour. And one of the most important things with mutton is that there's a substance called lanolin. And lanolin is produced by the glands. And it basically waterproofs the sheep. So that's why my sheep, you know, sheep are able to live outside. The wool gets covered in lanolin. It's waterproof. So basically when it rains, it just runs off. After about 5 years old, lanolin is what, when you have lamb, you get that tacky flavour. You know, that's just, you know, feels a bit fatty on your tongue. On top of your mouth, that's basically lanolin. But with sheep, after about 5 or 6 years, they stop producing it. So basically, you don't get that tacky flavour. So with my sheep, and I did it myself, when I first had it, I thought it was going to be tough and tacky, but it was the opposite. It was just pure sheep flavour, no tackiness, and it was tender. You know, so it's, So I think, you know, like I say, like in Greece, you know, there's two, you know, it's, you know, the potential with it. If you think, like, there are millions and millions of sheep in this country, you know, like every lamb you have, there's a sheep. So, you know, I think there's literally, I think there's probably like 50, but it might be, say, 15 million sheep in this country. So anyone here, you know, you're probably looking at, say, I don't know, my guess would be probably like 2 million sheep are currently going to slaughter without getting fattened, if you see what I mean. Mm. Create the market for it, then, you know, there is just a huge opening for young people. You know, like I always say, young people, but anybody with animal farmers, and get people fattening sheep. And we've got people who farm veg and salad. You know, once you plow land, plant loads of seeds and try and grow it, like, nature is just trying to stop you. If you put ruminants on the land, you're with nature. So I basically say I'm not clever enough to farm against nature. I need it on my side. And I think, you know, that's why I just think this is such a good way of getting new people farming, basically. And it's very rewarding. I know you have to kill the poor, but you do have to kill the poor things. But if you follow me on Instagram particularly, any sheep that I get very fond of, I keep. So I've probably got now 12 sheep.
Indeed.
I've got 12 sheep that are now just basically pets. But what they do is, I was out there tonight, just come in. I actually got a race. My little friendly ones came in. I was just sitting there, and like, it's just actually quite beautiful. But what happens is, I get new sheep in, and they could be wild, crazy things from the moor. Once they come to my land, what happens is, I go in the field, they run away to the other side. My friendly ones come running up to me and act like dogs, and the other ones are just watching. And within 2 or 3 days, they're all really calm, and they just follow me around with the bucket. You know, like, so it actually helps my system hugely, because the more relaxed sheep are, when your food goes into the rumen, you're going to have to edit this so that you get that in. They basically zonk out on the field, and they're fermenting. You know, they've got a fermentation chamber, is their rumen. They zonk out, and the more asleep they are, I personally feel the more nutrients they're accessing. So I want sheep. We play this game, farmers play this game, alive or dead, where you've got a sheep, and it'll be on the floor, and it'll look like it's dead, and you see how quite close you can get to it before it suddenly jumps up. And the closer I get to sheep, the more I know it's basically just absolutely zonked out, fermenting, you know? So I don't want sheep in the field stressed and panicked. I want sheep just absolutely loving life and then just passing out. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's the best way of doing it, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we need to incorporate more of that in our diet anyway. More mutton, I suppose, more of that, but less crap meat, less cheap meat, less of this.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I detest factory farming. I think what we do, particularly the pigs and chickens, is shocking. And there is actually, I think there's no need for it. I think if you get pigs and you can incorporate chickens onto a regenerative system, in Australia, they've got millions of chickens following sheep. So basically you have the sheep that go through, the chickens follow them, the chickens pick through their food. And basically, you know, that's like in nature, what I've got now is my sheep are in a field. There's a species of bird called the meadow pipit. The meadow pipit, you don't see them all summer. I've now got like 100 meadow pipit. They're quite a rare bird, but they're now filling the sheep and they're eating all their poo. The sheep, the meadow pipit in turn are pooing on the ground, which is very healthy for the ground. So which nature, you know, wherever ruminants go, birds follow. And so that in Australia in particular, they're farming sheep in fields on huge numbers. They're moving and then they're putting chicken there afterwards. So that's what I mean. Like, if you just look at what nature does, we could do the same. There's just no need to have all these chicken in factories. And like I say, like, you're not spending money on chemical fertilizer. You're actually, your fertilizer is a live animal that you can actually have meat from it.
Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah, exactly. It seems so simple, and I think I'm quite hopeful that it will start happening. More people will realize that.
I think so. It's just like I say, like, yeah, within 1 minute of being on my farm, you understand that this way of farming is the way to save the planet. You know, like, it's just, I'm not like some god type. You know, I'm not like, you know, you just. It's just obvious. Like, it's, you know, the world we have has been created by ruminants going around pooing, and, you know, and it's every bit of soil we got is working. Like, all the arable land, that's how the soil is created, but they're just basically using up what the ruminants have done, and then they get to a point where they put chemicals and then they need to get ruminants back. You know, it's just not rocket science that, you know, ruminants are just so in tune. Like, when they hit land, it just transforms. Within like 6 months, a land transforms. It's just, you know, it happens. That's the other bit to be positive about, is it's so quick. Like, it's not like it takes 10 years. Within 6 months, your land changes. Like, the bacteria, the microorganisms in the soil are just ready. Like, it's not, Freddie does his pigs. His soil had an organic matter, which is carbon, of 1%. And after like 3 or 4 years of pigs, it went up to like 6 or 7%, which is just, that's probably like tons and tons of carbon being stored in the soil that wasn't there previously. You know, it happened so quickly. Like, it's not like these chemicals have killed everything. Like, everything's still there and it multiplies so quickly. If you just nudge it, it just explodes. You know, that's the thing I'm most optimistic of geared up to recover really quickly, from what I can, you know, from what I can see. You know, like it's you know, it's almost like you just know, like say we did disappear as a species, like in nature, like within not very long, we'd just be like, yeah, okay, whatever, like that's cracking. You know, like it's just phenomenal. Nature is just incredible. Like, you know, we haven't had like the way I'm farming now, you know, like I've never seen a peregrine falcon here ever. Like, and now I'm farming in a way that's all, I'm leaving every, all the buds in the trees, all the nature there. We've got a lot of wood pigeon now, just, you know, feeding on them. And then, you know, I've now found two dead wood pigeon carcasses killed by a peregrine falcon. And then I've now seen a peregrine falcon killing. Like, that's just happened so quickly. Like, you know, in living memory around here, no one's seen a peregrine falcon like for you. And now suddenly, within 2 years of doing this, you know, like, it's just, you know, it's just, it's crazy. Nature's like, yeah, just frightening, really.
That's amazing. That's really good case for your case, actually, for doing this silver pasture. You know, more people should be doing that.
Basically. Well, silver pasture is good. So we've got a species, our fastest declining bird is called the willow tit.
Yeah.
And in my woodland, we've got loads of them. everywhere that I coppice and put sheep, that's where the willow tits are. They don't. Mm. No animal likes a clouded, a completely covered canopy. That's just against nature. Like, you know, nature, everywhere I open up space and let in light, that's where the willow tits are going. So I've got Devon Wildlife Trust. Like, they just can't believe how many willow tits I've got. They can't believe where I'm doing the most activities, where all the willow tits are. Mm. And it's just, you know, it's just, we just, it makes absolute sense. So, yeah, so like, again, you know, if you just see the floor of my woodland, where I've got a place where I haven't coppiced, and there's literally ivy and sorrel. Where I've coppiced, there's probably 200 plants. And I've worked, a guy from the Eden Project's come down, brilliant guy called Dan Ryan, he's come and have a look, and he's just blown away. You know, like, so all these seeds are still there. This season, they're 400 years old. Do you know what I mean? That's what I mean about nature. It's like, it's not like these things have disappeared. If you just get the soil conditions right, 400 years later, these plants are popping up. These plants are like, oh, there's some sunlight. Oh, there's some sheep shit. Right.
Insane.
Is it, you know, like, so you don't need a seed bank. You don't need to buy seeds. The seeds are all there from 400 years ago. I didn't know that. I did not know that. I'm like, you know, like, you suddenly see all these seeds come up. And you're like, and you do then start thinking, shit, my family have farmed this for 400 years. They would have, that would have been seeds from what they were doing 400 years ago. You know, it's just, it's insane, really. It's insane.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically just brilliant. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, all this stuff, they also have an impact on the what we call rewilding as well, the whole thing. So basically,
yeah.
I mean, as a term, the rewilding can be very generic and very vague.
Yeah.
But I mean, in terms of trying to make nature in UK, at least what we're talking now is UK, but it reintroducing species, like more predators and stuff, is that something that can happen? or is it...
I don't know if you... I sort of say, I think rewilding could be beautiful, but rewilders are twats. but basically, I would say it's the biggest Tory con of the lot. Basically, that, you know, I could go on and on about this, but I would say we don't need to rewild. We don't just need to plant, like, cover the whole area in wilderness. We can do both. We can actually increase biodiversity and feed people. My big worry at the moment is that companies are basically the very, very super rich. And as a result of COVID, all the money's flowed to the top. Basically, a lot of pension funds are now buying up land. They're going to start planting trees and rewilding. They're going to be paid to do it by property companies to offset. Start building stuff, they can offset and they're going to start paying the same people. So you've got this almost like, all the people pushing this are all very wealthy people who I suspect have got a lot of invested interest in this. I think, I just don't, if we rewild, and actually Henry Dimbleby just came out today, there's a thing on Wicked Leaks, I literally just posted it on my Instagram, where we've got to feed ourselves. If we rewild, we're going to offshore all of our terrible farming methods to other countries and expect them to do it. We'll just put our carbon burden, our biodiversity burden elsewhere. We need to find a way of working with nature and producing food, you know, to me, silver pasture is just the most obvious thing. It is, you know, I hate to say it, and yeah. I think a lot of people, you know, when you think about it, if it sounds too good to be true, it is too good to be true. Just by leaving your countryside, go absolutely wild. And basically what happens is, if you keep animals out, if you fence deer out, which if you speak to a rewilder, I'll show you someone who hates deer. Like it's just the weirdest thing. They just hate deer. So the first thing they do is fence woodland and let it all grow.
Yeah.
But then you just get a covered wood canopy and you're bedded. Yeah. You know, I've got a woodland that was covered for 4 years and nothing's growing. And there's no nature, there's no nothing. So basically, and in terms of releasing animals, I actually think brilliant. I mean, I think very close to me is the key rewilder in the country. I won't say his name. We actually get on quite well.
Derek.
Yes. So we and Derek actually get on quite well. He's 4 miles from me, down in the same valley. So he's currently got wildcats in cages. He's got lynx in cages. What's that lady on? Did you watch Tiger King?
My wife watched it. She told me about it.
There was a woman on Tiger King, the one that I can't remember her name. But basically, Derek, so as far as I can see, rewilding seems to involve having lots of cats in cages. So, you know, but obviously, because I got my sheep in the woods, I keep on asking Derek to make sure his lynx are still in the cage, because obviously lynx, the first thing they do would be, for me, I think it'd be, you know, the potential is really exciting. If I knew lynx were in my valley, you know, I would just make sure that the sheep weren't in there at night time. If they were killed, I would ask to be compensated, you know, but I'd hope they wouldn't. I think I could farm around nature, but the trouble is, I don't think this is why it's being done. I think it's being done because it's a huge Tory con. It's basically designed so that we stop producing food, corporate companies take over, do food production. We offshore all our food production. So I think, like I say, I think rewilding could be good, but the people behind it are twats. And I made no secret of that.
Offshoring our carbon emissions, basically.
But it's like, there's a lot of people now in the restaurant industry in London. They're basically planting trees in Madagascar, and they're offsetting their carbon by planting trees in Madagascar. They're saying they're carbon neutral. Madagascar itself is going through huge droughts, and they are a lot of people starving to death because basically their land, they're not farming it. So you've got restaurants in this country offsetting their carbon, telling the world that they're carbon neutral because they're planting trees in the country that's basically where its population is starving. Now that's the future of where this is heading. We do have a colonial past, and as far as I can see, this whole carbon offsetting is basically like our colonial future. You know, like we are just going to start using the other parts of the world to basically offset our, we're just going to do that.
No, you're right. I mean, it's in that respect sounds a bit grim.
So Derek's standing away from us. He's had beavers escape, and a lot of them. And I've seen signs of them where I am, and I love them. I think they are incredible, and I'm dying for beavers to come along. And I could farm around beavers. I would love to have beavers. I'm hoping they're going to set up camp. And if I had lynx, we have got a lot of roe deer, but the roe deer, they would soon eat the roe deer, and they'd be after us, you know. So it's, if you're going to do things like lynx, you need a lot of woodland. And that, if they're going to start thinking about lynx, that means that their ambition is to have a lot of this country in woodland. And that means we ain't going to produce much food. And that means someone else has got to produce our food. You know, if you start, Derek himself says that our valley isn't big enough for lynx, and we've got a lot of wood in our valley. If our valley isn't big enough for lynx, then how many trees, what are they planning? I personally think rewilding will be like a billionaire. It's all going to the same dinner parties, and they'll be like showing off about who's got the most lynx and who's got the most this and who's got the most, and it'll become a rich person's elitist thing. And meanwhile, we'll be, and we'll be the one, I'll stop there. I'm going off on one now. So I think most of the people pushing rewilding actually live in South Kent. So I think some grizzly bears and wolves in South Kensington would be brilliant.
I'm up for it. Thank you. That's thank you so much. I won't take any more of your time.
That's really good fun.
Yeah.
So it's been a pain, but thank you very much. It's been really good fun.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Have a lovely night. Take it. Bye.
Thanks to all the Delicious Legacy podcast patrons who are making this podcast become true. So thanks to Rachel, thanks to Damien Bell, thanks to Mark Knight, and Dimitris N, and Dimitris M, and Stereos, and Phil, and Andrew Cabanis, and Andrew Kenrick, and Paul Cooper. And thanks to Michael Zanfardino, Elaine Joseph, Alexis R, Steve Holloway, Leah Potts, Lauren Gaither, Chris Banks, Dwight Brown, Zeynep, Guy Joyner, Tom E, and Greg Duncan. Thank you. Thank you very much, all of you, for your support all these months. And all the rest of you out there that I forget. My name is Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy podcast. Have a lovely week, and see you again next time. Good night.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.